A new book is shining a light on an unusual chapter in the life of the founder of Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy. In the second half of the 19th century, the New Hampshire native was a wealthy and prominent public figure, but toward the end of her life, Eddy faced a legal challenge to her wealth and her fitness to manage her own affairs, and it came in part from inside her own family. Historian Peter Wallner is the author of the book Faith on Trial, Mary Baker Eddy, Christian Science, and the First Amendment. He previously wrote an acclaimed two-volume biography of New Hampshire's only U.S. president, Franklin Pierce. Peter Wallner, welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Mary Baker Eddy is in her mid-80s when this suit begins. How would you describe her at this stage in her life, as well as the public attitudes toward her and toward Christian Science?
She was considered by Mark Twain and others to be the most famous woman in America at this time. She had moved to Concord in 1889 from Boston. And at that time, people thought she was moving into semi-retirement. She was very much in charge of her life and of her church. But nevertheless, because she was so difficult to get in contact with, especially for the media or even for her adopted son and her biological son, there was some sense that maybe she was not competent and that she was being held under the control of the Christian Science Church officials, who were somehow misappropriating her wealth and controlling what they thought might be an incompetent old woman. She was far from that.
And Eddy's son and adopted son play roles in this lawsuit. What are they looking to do?
That's an interesting point. I think they had different motives. Her biological son had been estranged from her for many, many years. He had been taken away from her as a child, raised by people in Minnesota, and he had become an illiterate prospector. He needed her money. He wanted her wealth. Her adopted son was out for revenge because he felt his relationship with his stepmother had been undermined by Christian Science officials, and so he had been sort of drummed out of the Christian Science Church and out of Mary Baker Eddy's affections, and so he joined the plaintiffs in the case, I think largely to get revenge on Christian Science officials.
And that then becomes the crux of the case, not so much about whether Mary Baker Eddy is able to handle her own affairs, but really Christian Science itself?
Yes, and that wasn't even the motives of the son or adopted son. That was the motives of the press and the lawyers in the case. They were out to discredit Christian Science. They thought the religion itself was dangerous, that it was against science, that it was it believed in health care by mental reasons rather than by physicians, and they thought the Christian Science itself was dangerous. So they used, I think, in many cases, the son and adopted son for their own purposes, which was to get at Christian Science.
And how does that then play out in the courtroom? How do lawyers essentially try to put this school of religious thought to the test?
Well, what Eddy did was very smart. Over a time, she and her lawyer, Frank Streeter from Concord, had a media campaign in which they brought in reporters and psychiatrists to study her and to interview her. Reporters and photographers came out in the press with stories that said that she was quite sane and quite in charge of her life. So by the time the case went to court in August of 1907, it was pretty obvious to the plaintiffs that she was at least going to make a decent showing if she was interviewed by the court. Therefore, they turned their attention entirely to her views on religion, claiming that they showed her delusions and showed her to be insane or suffering from senile dementia. In the end, the judges were not going to listen to a lot of talk about her religion. They simply did not believe that you could connect her religion to the fact that she was incompetent. So they ruled that all evidence prior to 1890 and most of the material, most of the witnesses that the plaintiffs have gathered were people who knew her in her early days of Christian Science when her religions did seem to be somewhat superstitious in many ways. She had changed her views quite a bit by 1906, 1907. Nevertheless, the court then ruled out all of the testimony prior to 1890. And in doing so, the plaintiffs were left without much of a case. So they asked the court to dismiss the case. They dropped the charges, and they did this partly because they felt it would be easier to prove that she was incompetent and insane after she died, and that therefore they would challenge her will.
And she did live for several more years after
this case.
She lived
until December 1910. She died at 89, 89 and a half. And she was in Massachusetts at that point. She left Concord immediately after the case was over, feeling somewhat vulnerable at Pleasant View because of the fact that the home was so close to the road and the reporters and photographers were always camped out in front of her house.
And what happened to her son and her adopted son after this?
Well, they eventually did settle with her. adopted son was granted $245,000 by her to try to fend off any possible challenge to her will, because she wanted to leave her money to Christian Science, to the growth of her church, and she gave her adopted son $45,000. Doesn't sound like a lot today, but of course in 1907 that was quite a bit of money. Nevertheless, when she died, they still challenged her will, and in both cases, of course, they failed again to challenge her will, and they had to accept the $245,000 and $45,000 settlements that she had given them.
Does this case set any precedents or have any lasting effect in our legal system about how religion is treated when it comes to someone's competence?
I think it does, in the sense that basically the courts in 1907 decided that anything regarding someone's religious beliefs was simply not subject to legal court action. It was basically decided that there was nothing about her religion that was relevant to whether or not she was a competent person or whether or not she was in charge of her religion. The court simply refused to deal with that. They simply accepted the idea that people could believe whatever they wanted, didn't affect necessarily their competency to handle their financial affairs and their daily lives.
Finally, what do you think you've learned about Mary Baker Eddy from studying this episode in her life?
I didn't come away believing in Christian Science particularly, but I thought she was at least a very honest person in what she believed in. She truly believed everything that she said, and she started, began a church that other people followed as well.
Dr. Peter Wallner, thanks so much for your time today.
Enjoyed talking with you.
Peter Wallner is a historian and author of the new book Faith on Trial, Mary Baker Eddy, Christian Science, and the First Amendment. He's set to speak Wednesday at the New Hampshire Historical Society in Concord. You'll find a link to more about that talk at nhpr.org.